Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, June 23rd. Today marks a big anniversary for equity in sports in our schools. Title IX is considered a landmark in a civil rights struggle for equality. This weekend, a longtime champion of education, State Senator Michelle Kidani, announced she's stepping down because of health reasons. What does this mean for voters with elections just around the corner? An upcoming art exhibition across the Pacific features a baker's dozen local artists we consider the coconut. Money, love it, hate it, you can't live without it. A new book explores the emotions behind the paper that lines our wallets. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today marks 54 years since a landmark civil rights amendment known as Title IX was signed into law. Congresswoman Patsy Meik was one of the driving forces behind the federal legislation. Kim Cross is the author of a piece in the online publication Long Lead. Her article, Tidal Waves, is a nod to the anniversary. Cross focuses on a lawsuit filed by Campbell High School polo player Ashley Badis. We talked to Cross earlier this week about the case.
It's interesting because I've been an athlete for my whole life, and I really did not appreciate, I think, the rights that were gained by the women before me. And I didn't realize the depths of my own ignorance about Title IX and women's rights. I did not know how the law was enforced. I did not realize until I did the research that the burden of enforcement largely falls on women and girls and their parents, because it's not just automatically enforced like I had thought. I was shocked by that.
Yes, and you focused on the lawsuit here. And I remember when I first heard about this legal challenge, I was like, wow. And knowing the history behind what Patsy Meik fought for, I was just like, wow, how can this be?
Right, in Patsy Meik's home state, where this originated, this law, I was really struck also by the idea that high school girls were learning their rights and standing up for them. I think it is so interesting that in high school, you don't generally know your rights yet. And if you do, it's a very vulnerable time to stand up for yourself against what's probably the biggest institution in your young life, which is your school. These high school girls realized they were not being treated fairly and equally with other male athletes at their school. And they went to their administration to try to talk it out and solve the problem. And when they were ignored, they ended up having to bring a lawsuit to enforce this law that had been in effect for decades.
And so, yeah, when you read that, I guess, what was it that touched you about that?
Well, I thought back to my days as a high school athlete, and when they started talking about locker rooms, I thought, oh my gosh, I was on the soccer team, and I actually went and connected with my old soccer teammates on Facebook and said, did we have a locker room? And they said, no, we didn't have a locker room. We were allowed to sometimes use the boys visiting football team locker room if it was raining. And they said, I didn't realize what we didn't have until I saw the field house. And then I realized, why do they have all those things? And we didn't have them. So I just realized how ignorant I was in high school and how I don't know if I had known my rights, if I would have had the courage to stand up. But here were these high school girls doing it, and they got some pushback and retaliation, and that really stirred my blood, because I think it is such a hard thing to stand up for yourself as a woman, but especially as a high school girl, when you're still kind of figuring out who you are and coming into your own confidence.
Well, I love that in the article, you know, you use a lot of pictures, and that drives home that imagery, you know, right? One image worth a thousand words. But yeah, just to be able to get a sense of place when you're talking about of the conditions that the girls were playing sports under.
I have to credit the photographer and videographer for the imagery. But one of the videos in the story shows Ashley trying to throw the water polo ball and treading water in the ocean. The fact that these high school girls were water polo players, which is a pool sport, and having to practice in the ocean because they didn't have a pool was astounding to me. And to get a sense of how hard that would be, I went and I got in the pool with Ashley and learned how to throw the water polo ball in proper conditions. And then we got in the surf and tried to do it. And I realized just how hard it was and how it doesn't even feel like the same sport.
Oh gosh, no. And the buoyancy is so different. Pool water versus seawater. And so, yeah, it's definitely not the same.
Right. And it put them at such an advantage. They weren't even able to get in a pool before the first tournament of the season. And just imagining having to get conditioned and to have the skills to be able to compete without having practice in a proper pool, it's kind of incredible.
I was fortunate to have covered Patsy Mink when she left Congress and she came back and ran for Honolulu City Council. So I, as a City Hall reporter, I was able to see her in action on the local level after holding a position and doing what she did in D.C. to come home and to still make a difference on some basic things about sewers and roads. But I just remember when my daughter was going off to college and when we were looking at schools, and I realized, wow, I was on the very first women's crew team at Santa Clara. And thinking back, wow, has it been that long? And just the headway that girls and women have made in the field of athletics, right? Whether it's new sports, whether it's flag football or, gosh, just sports that weren't available at the time when Patsy Mink was around.
Right. I think about how different my life would have been if I had been born before Title IX, like my mother, who would have been a great athlete and just wasn't born in time for it. So I think about all of the athletes like me who might not appreciate how those doors were opened for them because of someone like Patsy Mink and the law that she got codified.
Well, you know, I was just in Chicago for the opening of the Presidential Center, and I was searching as I was walking through the museum for anything Hawaii related. And the very first thing I saw was an image of Patsy Mink, you know, in her little briefcase there in our nation's capital. And that was so powerful to think that, yes, look what she has done. Look what Hawaii has done to help improve this country.
Absolutely. We owe a lot to her.
And then, gosh, what do you hope people remember on this day?
I hope girls and women and everyone appreciate how important it is to speak up when you see injustice. Enforcement of this law and other civil rights laws often starts with vigilance and speaking out when you see something that isn't fair, isn't right. And that's what Ashley Badis and her teammates realize is this doesn't seem fair. We're not being treated fairly. And the fact that they needed to bring a lawsuit to enforce the law is remarkable, but good on them for doing it. One of the lasting impressions for me was how much they changed things for future girls. They didn't actually get to experience the changes they fought for, but because by the time the lawsuit resolved, they had already graduated, but they made things better for the women behind them and the girls behind them. And one of my favorite changes was they created a whole new sport in Hawaii for girls in high school, and it's water polo. They opened that door for around 1,000 girls in Hawaii across the whole state.
It's amazing when you see now what is available, right? There's wrestling. There's just all kinds of great stuff with like soccer, you know, so many more possibilities just to show what women and girls can achieve.
Absolutely. And I can't say enough about the importance of sports for girls. It builds confidence. It builds aggressiveness. It builds abilities that translate to real life off the field. And one insight I gleaned from the reporting that didn't make it in the story is that I looked at a lot of the women who were first-generation Title IX athletes who got a lot of pushback at the time. There's still pushback, but they got a lot of pushback and a retaliation. And they went on to become extremely successful in the boardroom. And a lot of them became CEOs and vice presidents of huge corporations. And now they're the ones donating millions of dollars to put their name on a field house that they didn't have when they were in college.
Yes, athletics certainly teaches us a lot about life skills, you know, you can develop and that will help you as you live your life.
Absolutely.
Anything else that you would want to share with our listeners about Patsy Mink and just the remarkable life that she led? and the legacy that she leaves us with.
I think I will always remember how outspoken she was and how she delivered the truth, hard truths, with such grace. She never lost her poise, but she wasn't afraid to speak the truth and to not rock the boat. She was willing to take things and make them different, even knowing that she might not be able to benefit from the changes, but women after her would. And that is the essence, I think, of team sports, is taking one for the team.
Yes, absolutely. And Patsy Mink was a terrific role model for so many of us. But thank you so much, Kim. Really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was Kim Cross, who penned a story on Title IX for the publication Long Lead. The online article looks at a legal challenge filed in Hawaii on behalf of the James Campbell High School girls team. Cross questions whether future cases about equity will be addressed quickly now that the Trump administration has announced it will move much of the work in the Civil Rights Office from the Federal Department of Education to the Justice Department. She expressed concern that any legal remedy may be delayed with staff shortages and different administration priorities. Look for an excerpt of her story on our website later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Master of Human Resources Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious.
You don't expect to find a swimming pool in the middle of the desert.
The rule number one when planning a golf course in China is to not call it a golf course.
Join us and hear the world.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of serving the community local-style foods and being a place where family and friends can meet and share bentos, saimin, or their own idea of island comfort meals.
Candidates vying for a seat in public office are off and running as the political season has officially kicked off. The deadline for filing with the State Office of Elections has passed, but an announcement by Senator Michelle Kidani over the weekend has raised some eyebrows. Joining us this morning is Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you wrote a story earlier this year at the beginning of the session about something that was being shared privately about questions about whether Michelle Kidani would continue through session.
Yeah, there was a challenging story. It met with both glory and the opposite of glory. in a nutshell, the Civil Beat had been hearing for a number of years about concerns about the senator's allegedly declining mental health, losing her place in meetings, tripping up on her words, and she was having folks actually walk with her around the Capitol to get to where she needed to go. And it finally rose to a level that we felt we had to look into it, and we were able to confirm that she was suffering from dementia. And of course, that's a serious concern, not only from a personal level for what a family has to go through, but in this case, there's another component. She is a public figure. She's not just any public figure, a very influential senator, involved deeply in education, also the Senate vice president. And then there were some questions raised about whether she would continue in office. And so now we have this announcement that came several weeks after the June 2nd deadline saying, yeah, she is stepping down. Dementia was not mentioned in her press release. Health concerns were. She cited her doctor, her physician, saying it was time, and so here we are with the big question of, well, you know, dementia aside, how do we then fill her seat? And this is where it gets a little murky.
Yes. I mean, it's a difficult thing, you know, dealing with cognitive health. But, you know, at the same time with the political process, right? I mean, now that the deadline is passed, the decision falls on the party, right, to come up with
right, although it's, we have a follow-up story running tomorrow about this, and I'm still making some calls, but a lot of people weren't aware that a new law was passed. It actually became law April 29th, and there wasn't really much opposition to it, but in a nutshell, it spells out the appointment process, and very briefly, it's similar to other processes when someone, when a vacancy occurs at the ledge. But in a nutshell, the Democrats in that area, her area is Mililani, the greater Mililani area, Senate District 17, they'll pick a couple of names, people that apply for the job. They'll send three names to the governor. The governor will then pick. But here's the thing. The governor will pick someone only to serve temporarily. That will be until November 3rd. November 3rd is the general election. There'll be a special election just for that district. And in this case, each of the four parties, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Green, have the option to pick one candidate to be on that ballot. What you won't have is you won't have a contested primary. Her departure, had she resigned or announced that she was leaving prior to that deadline, June 2nd, it would have triggered an open primary. You bet a lot of people would have run for that seat, but that's not the case now. So we're now going to have to find out. I mean, you are essentially allowing the Democratic Party, which controls the party politics in this state, to pick what really should be the right of the Mililani voters. But this, of course, is in statute.
Yes, and so it will be interesting to see, whose name surfaces. But, yeah, maybe, you know, there are people in her district who would have filed had they realized that there would have been an opening.
Well, I think you've already seen it. Think about Carl Rhodes, who, you know, announced he was stepping down well ahead of the end of session. And a number of people, at least five people, are vying for that state Senate seat. Same thing goes in the state house, where there's a couple of vacancies, Del Albalotti's seat and whatnot. And there's five or six people running just from Democrats alone. There's also Republicans and other people running. Whenever there's an open seat at the ledge, particularly a state Senate seat, because there's only 25 of them, you have people lining up to get in there. Because once you get in, you pretty much are guaranteed a job for as long as you'd like. There's no term limits. But that will not happen with this current situation. And that does have people wondering, why couldn't we? Well, why couldn't the senator have maybe announced earlier? But, of course, her doctor just now advised her. And so that is what she's telling everybody through her press release.
Yes. Well, our thoughts go out to her and her family. I mean, I've covered her since she was a staffer at Reen Mancho's, in her office.
Oh, my God.
As city council.
That dates me, yes. Quite a career.
Yes.
18 years alone in the state Senate, serving the folks in the greater Mililani area, Michelle Kadani.
Yes, a long public servant. But thank you so much, Chad.
Take care, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair. You can read his coverage online at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation, congratulating all graduating seniors. Actions such as planning sober rides home can help graduates live their best lives ahead.
Have you ever wanted to hear Ringo Starr cover Snoop Dogg? Maybe a more up-tempo version of a song you like. The world's largest streaming service is offering a new AI tool just for that.
This will launch as a paid add-on. All users on Spotify will be able to enjoy these songs.
I'm Amory Sievertson. What will fan-crafted AI remixes and covers mean for fans and artists? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, for nearly 90 years providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omau, okaholabe, ohawaii.
Earlier in today's show, we marked the 54th anniversary of the Educational Amendments of 1972, otherwise known as Title IX. The legislation was championed by Patsy Mink, who was the first woman of color elected to Congress. Mink grew up on a sugarcane plantation on Maui and fought hard for her right to an education. When she was denied entry from every medical school she applied to, she became one of two women admitted to the University of Chicago Law School in her year. When no law firm would hire her, she started her own practice. And when her party pushed her out of the race for the Territorial House of Representatives for a male candidate, she ran again and won. Mink's resilience in the face of adversity led her to become the lead sponsor of Title IX. The law bans sex-based discrimination in education programs or extracurricular activities funded by the government. Thanks to Title IX, the number of women who participated in high school and college sports grew from 300,000 to 3 million in just 50 years. But for today's quiz, we want to know, what was Patsy Mink's campaign slogan when she ran in the 1990 special election against Mufi Hanneman? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Contemporary artists in Hawaii are the subject of a debut exhibition in Lower Manhattan that opens this Thursday. Niu Systems considers the coconut both in form and function. Some familiar names make up the 13 artist show, including Kainoa Gusby, Nenea Lum, and Amber Khan. Curator John Santos is a graphic designer who put the show together. He saw it as a way to bridge his life in Honolulu with his involvement in the East Coast art scene. Santos spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about carving out a niche for himself as an art dealer for local contemporary artists.
I realized I had a skill to stand in a booth at an art fair and sell artwork. And I thought this would be a really powerful way to create value and to introduce these artists into a global marketplace. And I think the one thing that I was most moved by was that even if I didn't sell anything, the amount of people who came into the booth to learn about the work and to ask questions about what was happening or what the medium was, in particular with Nanea Lum and her kapa, I thought this was very powerful. It was a kind of exposure and promotion that I think is really rare and not typically understood in a project sense as a way to really generate important work of value, even though the art fair is, you know, a very commercial context for it. I thought it would be really important to figure out a way to generate revenue streams for artists living and working in Hawaii, because from what I could tell, it was very rare for me to meet an artist in Hawaii who could make a living from making their art. And I know that there are examples of many of them. I think in particular, my specialty with contemporary art is really specific and narrow. And it's a lot different than artists who are maybe working with different modes or have different goals in terms of what they want to achieve with their art.
What do you think global audiences can learn from the Hawaii artists that you know of and whose work you help to platform?
I think that in this day and age, we lack a sense of scale, metaphorically, spiritually, and physically, meaning we don't really understand our relationship to the world and to the universe in terms of like our human scale in relation to like the building. Or we can understand the building we're in, but we can't really understand like the land that we're in. And I think what makes Hawaii so unique is how far away it is from every other major mass of land, and also how small the islands are and how historically the people of these islands have been able to observe natural systems in a way and create a system of respect and responsibility to contextualize their presence and their place on this land. And I think that's what makes the expression and the artwork from this place so unique and unlike almost everything I've seen. It is definitely in its own category. And I think, obviously, the tropes that I'm thinking of specifically are the ones that are combining contemporary approaches to form making with traditional art forms and traditional practices, just to be specific. So for example, when I talk about kapa, I understand that there is a huge kapa world in Polynesia of makers and creators all over a huge mass of land and ocean. And I think, for example, the way Nanea Lum approaches the way that she uses kapa is unlike any other form of it that I've seen. She uses it in a really contemporary way. And she celebrates the materiality and uses it as a surface to reproduce images that you might see Xeroxed on a piece of paper. And I think that approach is so sophisticated.
Tell us more about how the idea for this exhibition came together.
So originally I was playing around with the title Coconut Logic, which I'm not even sure how I came up with the pairing of those two words. And I am so new to Hawaii and there are so many things that I don't know. So of course I reach out to my colleagues and artists who I collaborate with to get their opinion. And it was Ka'ili Chun who pulled me over to point out how the word coconut and the way that we understand it from like an American perspective, it really does not consider the depth and the range and the meaning of the word niu and how complex the term is in terms of it, how it refers to an object, not just the object of the coconut, not just as a means for like consumption, but to think about the husk and the inside and the pulp and the juice and the roots of the plant and everything that took to nurture and care for this plant and how it is cultivated even before it becomes a coconut plant to when it's harvested and we use it. And I was really humbled by this reminder of this, all of the relationality that's involved in the niu and how this is a reflection actually of my existence. In fact, I've decentered myself from a lot of my practice and I'm really humbled by that. That's a big change in perspective for me. And living in New York, people tend to center themselves in the narrative. There's a very entrepreneurial spirit here. People come from all over the world to create something. And I've learned in Hawaii that there's a different way to exist and there's a different way to create. And there's a different way for me to acknowledge the people who I'm working with and allow for their ideas and their wisdom to become a part of the framework of the work that I'm creating. And so I'm still on this journey into developing this new perspective. I feel like I've only walked a few steps on a long path. And I feel like this show marks a bit of a period of time, 6 years of being in Hawaii. And I feel like it's only the first step. And if you know how time works in New York, 6 years is an eternity. And in Hawaii, I feel like 6 years is a week.
In this exhibition, it's 13 different artists who are from Hawaii or live in Hawaii. And each of them are responding to what it means to live, work, and think. Are there particular works that you think audiences will find the most resonant or that they'll struggle with the most?
So one artist's work that I think a lot of people will struggle with is Sean Connolly's, because I think it's the most abstract and the most challenging. And he has created a body of work that interprets structure and the way he understands the Aina, which, you know, ends up being translated as a really rigid abstract form with lashings that were taught to him by Native Hawaiian practitioners. And I think that work to me is also the most interesting in that it probably is the last kind of representation you would imagine coming from someone who was making artwork about being in Hawaii. So in the same breath, it's the most complex work to sort of understand because it's architectural. But in my mind, it is the most beautiful contemporary expression of the Aina. I think also Amber Khan's sculptures, I've seen Amber Khan develop her visual language, which originally began with exploring these tropes of tropical modernism in the way that she was stylizing the shapes of palm trees. And the way I've seen it evolve now, in the way that she uses found objects and unusual materials to create these abstract shapes that are reminiscent of a land that is sort of working to reconcile itself. So even though there are no figures in the work, you understand that humans are actually a part of this like disruption of natural processes. And I've never seen anything like it. I think it's a major contribution to sculptural form from Hawaii because it operates in a way, the way that she abstracts form is definitely in some kind of a new tradition, meaning you don't see of, let's say, like a Japanese sculptor who's working with wood, which will have marks and forms in it that speak to other forms of early abstraction from last century. And the way that she's dealing with abstraction is like a completely unique new style. And I feel that it will be remembered as, you know, in 100 years from now, it might be looked at as an evolution of Hawaiian contemporary form, which I think is really hard to do that. I've looked at a lot of the work from the last half of last century, and you can see references to cubism and European and American formal sort of approaches. And the way that she's handling it, I think, is so unique. And I definitely think it deserves note as her being a pioneer of kind of this new contemporary Hawaiian visual language.
It's so clear to me that you have so much passion for this and also, I mean, have had the experience of seeing something and saying, hey, I think they're doing this for the first time, or like, this feels new, this feels fresh. And from there, the impulse to share it with others. And then you start to understand, I mean, what this exhibition means for you and why you've made it in many ways your mission to elevate Hawaii artists to a global scale.
I appreciate that you're taking notice of it, because I feel like I've been doing this work not that long. I mean, like 4 or 5 years. And I feel that I don't feel like it's very noticed, but also I think that's also appropriate.
Well, anything else that you want to add or that you want to share with listeners?
I want to give a shout out to Ryan Lee Gallery, because it is a huge risk for them to take on this show and support. It's a huge risk for them to take on the show, ship all the artwork out, and provide the infrastructure and the support for mostly unknown artists. I just want to make sure that I mention how appreciative I am of this context that's being provided, this platform that's being provided for us to show the work, which is very rare. And part of my mission will be to continue partnering with other galleries and institutions to create more awareness about this work in New York.
That was designer and curator John Santos and HPR's Maddie Bender. The exhibition Neo Systems opens this Thursday at Ryan Lee Gallery in Manhattan. Look for links to find out more on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. The retrospective Toshiko Takaezu, Worlds Within, covers 70 years of her sculptures, paintings, and weavings. On now, honolulumuseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Wendell Pierce. You know him as Bunk in The Wire, and now he's taking on one of Shakespeare's giants, Othello. But it was playing Willie Loman on Broadway that took him somewhere personal, drawing on his own father to build that role. Pierce talks with us about his father and the men he plays. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
And now it's time to reveal the answer to today's quiz. Earlier, we reflected on the life and legacy of Patsy Mink. Mink was the first woman of color elected to Congress and the lead sponsor of the Educational Amendments of 1972. Today marks 54 years since Title IX was signed into law. Mink fought hard to attain her political aspirations, even running for president briefly in 1972 as an anti-war candidate. She received 2% of the national vote, and her advocacy against the Vietnam War earned her the name Patsy Pink on Capitol Hill. For today's quiz, we asked if you remembered Mink's campaign slogan from the 1990 congressional election. That election was held on September 22nd to fill the vacancy created by Daniel Akaka's appointment to the Senate. Mink was not the Hawaii Democratic Party's first choice. To set herself apart from her opponent's relative youth, Mink ran with the campaign slogan, "The Experience of a Lifetime." She won both the special election and the Democratic primary by close to 3% of the vote. We had no winners today. We stumped you on that quiz. But that is our question of the day. If you have one for us, send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
HPR is your source for music with culture. Every Sunday, we give you the recipe for a flavorful afternoon and evening. Start off with Kanikapila Sunday at 2 p.m.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kanikapila Sunday from Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Keali Iloma.
Mix in some Hawaii Kula Iwi at 6.
Aloha mai kako ke ho'olohene oko ya Hawaii Kula Iwi ma Hawaii Public Radio 1. Ovolo ke yo DJ Mermaid.
Then add a little spice from the Brazilian Experience at 7.
Olá, minha gente. Bem-vindos à Brazilian Experience. Sou eu, Sandy Tsukiyama, com vocês. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Brazilian Experience.
HPR is your favorite hotspot, serving up the music that feeds your day. Let's keep moving forward together. Donate at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Today we consider the emotional side of money. You might be thinking, what other side is there? Well, with rising prices all around us, how do we keep cool when thinking about our financial future? Kauai-based writer Terry Vickery is out with a new book called The Emotional Side of Money, A Roadmap to Financial Wellness. The book walks through why it's so hard to talk about money and guides readers on how they can achieve a sense of peace when thinking about finances. HPR's Kevin Allen spoke with Vickery, who seemed especially at ease on the lanai of her Kauai home.
We weren't taught. Nobody was taught to talk about money. You know, for parents, sex and money were the two taboo subjects. And, you know, they never talked about it. But kids learned from watching their parents, whether their parents were arguing about money or whether it was a taboo subject that they didn't even, the parents never talked about. But there's rarely been a household where it was talked about in a very normal, everyday tone of voice. And then we marry somebody or we have a partner, they've grown up in a household that probably did something, but not necessarily what your parents did. And then they don't talk about money, and it just perpetuates.
yeah, you know, your partner's parents did something else. So you guys kind of have like a mismatched view on money, but nobody's talking about it.
Exactly. To even know. Yeah.
Is that where a lot of that anxiety kind of stems from? Because
oh, yes. Absolutely.
I think anxiety is such a strange emotion, right? It's like your body is feeling like a fight or flight sort of feeling. So why is that so intrinsic, I guess, when it comes to discussing money and finances?
Well, I think our body talks to us before our brain does. And I can't tell you how many clients I have had say, thinking about money gives me a stomachache. Or I don't open my mail because it gives me a headache. They make the connection to their physical response to it. And it just does. And then, of course, you have the pounding heart. And at one place in the book, I said, so why would anybody pick up a book that makes your heart pound? Hopefully it's to be able to get some peace.
You know, that's kind of like the tough part for me, too. It's been sitting on my kitchen counter. And every time I look at the cover, honestly, I do feel a little bit, yeah. little bit of that heart pounding and a little bit of, oh, boy. And it's like, it's more than just money, right? It's more than just your income. I feel like a lot of it is inherited beliefs, you know?
Absolutely. Yes.
And so talk to me about like, yeah, that idea of inherited beliefs and why that might affect so much for people's view about money and their finances.
Well, I love to tell my own story because the women for three generations before me were the breadwinners in their families, which was highly unusual that far back. But they had to find a way to feed their kids. And my mom was 19 when I was born, and I had a four-year-old brother. So she was way too young to be having children and taking care of them. And so I grew up around extreme anxiety around money, and that's all I'd ever known. And so I have made the transition from scarcity thinking to abundance. And that's why I wanted to write the book, was to help people understand that you can make that transformation, but it takes a lot of intentionality and effort. And then the other piece, of course, is the whole part of the other people in your life that come into it. But moving from the money story you inherited to being able to pass along a financial legacy that is of your own choosing to your children makes all the difference in the world. And so that's the piece that I hope I can help people make that transition.
Right. It is a bit of like a trickle down. You know, I guess the way that your parents acted about money doesn't necessarily have to be the way that you act about money. And that can...
It absolutely does not.
That can further translate to your kids. And that is an interesting concept, I guess, just thinking generationally.
Well, and the generational thoughts are important, too, because so many people in what I call the middle generation are the people who may not know if their elderly parents have enough money to live on. And they may be concerned that at some point they're going to have to help their elderly parents at the same time that they're putting their own kids through college. So, you know, they're that sandwich generation that has it from both directions. But most of those parents don't want to talk about money either. And so getting to the place where you can even talk to mom and dad about money is often very stressful as well.
And that's kind of something I find difficult about talking about your finances, that it is almost like radioactive. I think it really does kind of seep into every aspect of your life, especially relationships, either that's with your husband or your wife or your parents. You know, how can money put stress on a relationship? And I guess what are maybe some key things to think about as you're kind of going through that trauma and trying to break through that cycle of not talking about money with those important people in your lives?
Well, how it can put stress on the relationship is exactly what you just said, the not talking about it and the feeling that you can't talk about, not only not doing it, but that belief that this is just a subject we can't discuss. And that really impacts quality relationships, you know, when you've got some subject as important as money that you can't talk about. And so in the book, at the end of each chapter, I have a section called Something to Think About. And it's prompts of what triggered for you in this chapter and who might you talk about money to, or who would you never talk to about money, Or what about money would you never talk about? And just some things to just guide some self-thinking. But there's a chapter called Partners in Money. And that chapter includes a whole list of those types of questions. And then the next set of questions of how to have the conversation. When you haven't been talking about money in your relationship, where do you start? And, you know, it matters when you're having the conversation. You don't want to do it in the midst of a heated argument about money. And you want to do it. And you know, a good way to start that conversation might be, you know, I've been reading this book and I've got some thoughts about money. And I'm just curious, would you be open to talking to me about those, about your own thoughts about money? And just kind of inviting a conversation at a quiet time, maybe over a glass of wine or something non-alcoholic. And, you know, just picking your time and paying attention to how you start that will be really important.
And I think, too, with a lot of like handling finances now in our current times, I think a big stressor is that everything seems to be getting more expensive,
yes.
Which is seems like something that we can't control. I went to 7-Eleven and I bought three things and it was $15. And that's just a lot of money. It was $80 to fill up my gas tank. You know, how can we combat, I guess, those feelings of hopelessness as everything around us seems to get more expensive and we just feel like we don't have control of that?
Well, we don't have control of an awful lot of it. You're exactly right. And so I think recognizing that is the first step. Is that okay? There are things we can control and there are things we absolutely cannot control. And thinking about what are the things we can control and what can I do about those things? Because these other things, worrying about it isn't going to help a thing and isn't going to bring those prices down. I personally believe that we can vote and that can make a difference. But I think a lot of people don't even think that's going to make that much difference. But I do think that it's important to focus on what we can do something about.
And your book it's a financial map, or it's a roadmap to financial peace. What does the light at that end of that tunnel look like, this idea of financial peace?
You know, you are the first person who's ever asked me that. And I love that question. I love it so much because I am living it. My son brought me to Kauai in November of 2018. We'd been here on the island 4 days and we checked out of our Airbnb that morning. And as we were about ready to check out, he said, "Mom, I've never seen you so happy. Why don't you come here to write your book? Because I've been talking about writing this book for a long time." And I don't know that thought ever would have crossed my mind, but I said, "Well, that's a really interesting idea. Maybe I'll do that." And then we went down to the Spouting Horn and we were sitting at the picnic table and just writing in our journals. And I found this later after I had moved here. I had written that day, "I will live here or I will die." I don't know where it came from. It wasn't like I wrote it and then I hung on to it because I didn't even remember having written it until I found it in that journal after I had moved. Wow. And so I think for me, getting to a place where I love my life has made the huge difference. And so getting to that place where I can be happy, then everything else just falls in place. And, you know, the money piece of it, I just have the calm that and the confidence that it'll take care of itself. It always has. Even when I didn't think it would.
And that's what that financial piece looks like.
That's so true. But you know, the security is not in the money. The security is in yourself and in the knowledge that whatever comes, I'll deal with it. I tell the story in the book of a friend who thought, she said at one point, "If I only had $100,000 cash in the bank, then I would feel secure." And a few years later, we were talking, and by that time, she had a 401k that was well over $100,000, and she had raised the number. She said, you know, if I had $200,000 in the bank. And I said, girl, you have that $100,000 in the bank that you said you'd be secure. And she said, well, that's retirement money. That doesn't count. And I said, well, you can count it or not. It's real money. It's literally sitting in an account. It's not going anywhere. And you do have the money. So if you want to not be secure, not feel secure, that's up to you. But you do have the money sitting in the bank. But I think that's such a wonderful example of how we play these games with our own mind. And the security, that's why I say the security is within yourself.
That was HBR's Kevin Allen and Koi author Terry Vickery. Vickery's book is titled The Emotional Side of Money, A Roadmap to Financial Wellness. You can find links on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to take a trip down memory lane and learn about a new video game that captures Honolulu during the 2008 financial crisis. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line. Record something, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.